ジラのサンタクロース赤い帽子がよく似合うお土産いっぱいミニラも一緒ほらほら聞こえる鈴の音
ランランランランランランプレゼント白いお船もにっこり揺れるランランランランランラン鐘が鳴るみんなで歌おうクリスマス
もうもうもうすらは空飛ぶ鳥だ遠い国からやってきたお手手をしっかり結んで踊る悲しい涙は吹き飛ばせ
ランランランランランランプレゼント怪獣たちの心も弾む雪よふれふれクリスマス
雪よふれふれクリスマス。 Hello and welcome to an especially festive edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club because after all it is Kaiju Christmas, the happiest time of year no doubt. Of course I am your host Elwood Jones and joining meAs always, is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Ho, ho, ho. And season's greetings to you, sir.
Thank you. Obviously, this is our second ever Kaiju Christmas. The first year that we did it, we previously looked at Destroyer Monsters, arguably the greatest Godzilla movie of all time. This time, we switched the focus and gone to Godzilla's only real rival on the Kaiju main stage, and that would be Gamera. Tonight we're going to be looking at Gamera 3, The Revenge of Iris, which rounded out the 90s trilogy. I believe I'm right in saying. We'll be obviously be talking about that a bit later in the show, but before we obviously get into that, there's been many exciting developments for ourselves and many exciting sort of releases that we just want to obviously touch on first of all. First off, if you follow our Facebook page, you have been made aware for us folks in the UK that Amazon recently had a little bit of a price break on the Criterion collection of Zakatoi. So the box set dropped down stupidly low. It dropped down to about £23. I'm not sure if it's still that now, but hopefully you will follow our Facebook page and manage to grab yourself the box set. I know that if you're like myself, you can probably expect it sometime in February, but it seemed like a really great offer, and hopefully you all took advantage of it. Stephen, did you grab yourself some Zakatoi, or do you?
I did. I wasn't going to, and then I thought it's £23 for 23 films or something.
I know.
It was just like, I've got a couple of them. It doesn't really matter if they're rubbish, does it? It was just too silly to turn down. But like you say, the delivery time was a bit unusual for Amazon.
That's one reason I put forward, because it means I don't have to pay for it for 2 or 3 months, so I've got time to find the money to pay for my frivolous spending. But the Zakatoi movies, they are sort of like a staple of not only like Shambara cinema, but sort of the pop samurai genre as well. The most recent one we had being the Beat Takashi Zakatoi in the sort of early 2000s, and we've not really seen anything from the franchise since, even though it's like one of the longest running franchises. It's up there with Django as having the most entries in its series. So the fact that you can get all of them collected on a really nice looking box set is even more advantage, especially because the distribution of these films, I don't think it ever really made it over to the UK. We got one or two, but we never got like a whole set the way that this has been obviously offered. And While it would, I was hoping for similar price breaks, we know, like the Female Prisoner Scorpion series from Arrow and their Battles Throughout Honors and Humanity, both of which I kind of missed out on when they had that low introductory price break, and now they're just like stupid trader prices, unless you're like Steven and got really lucky and picked them up cheap on eBay.
Yeah, yeah, you let it go, sir. Let it go.
How many episodes have we been going on about this set now?
Yeah, since about the beginning of the podcast.
Of course. The other box set that is out as well at the moment is Once Upon a Time in China trilogy. Now, it's unusual the fact they call it a trilogy when it's actually six films. So make of that what you will. But you can certainly get the Jet Li first three films in a very nice box set. And who's actually put this one out? Do you remember, Steven?
I'm holding it in my hand right now. This is by Eureka. Now, I forgot I'd ordered it because I didn't actually need it because I've got a perfectly good box set of all six from China or Hong Kong from a few years ago. Obviously, these are Blu-rays. It's actually got four films on it, even though it calls it a trilogy, because it's got Once Upon a Time in China and America, which is the sixth film, which is when Jet Li came back to it. But it doesn't really advertise it, except in like the fifth paragraph down on the back of the box. But it's got nice documentaries and extras. I haven't looked how good it looks. I imagine it'll look as good as a Hong Kong film from 91, 92, 93 looks, but they're classic films and films that we'll no doubt talk about. Eureka have done a few of these sets recently, the Police Story ones and Project A ones that they did recently. They may have even been the people that put out the City Hunter Blu-ray. I can't remember. So they obviously think there's a market for it.
Definitely so. I mean, the actual review of the box set, you will be able to see it on our site. As of when this podcast is released, David will be reviewing it as part of his Movie Vault series. And if you excuse the studio cats just having an aggro, because they're also rather upset they didn't get the Female Prisoner box set either. The actual series itself, really well worth checking out, as you said. Jet Li, obviously starring in the first three films before stepping away, and he was replaced by Vincent Zhao for the fourth and fifth films before Jet Li obviously returned for Once Upon a Time in America and China. The fourth film is really good. I really like it. And certainly the second film in the series is sort of really noteworthy for having this sort of legendary fight scene between Jet Li and Donnie Yen. A rematch that we would have to wait all the way until Hero to actually see, but it's sort of like renowned as being like one of these standout fight sequences in martial arts cinema. The third film as well is also pretty bonkers. I think the only sort of one that I never really got on with is the sort of first one, ironically, and it's kind of bizarre that it managed to still spawn this like huge saga out of a film which wasn't that particularly great to begin with. But certainly 2, 3, and 4 are just real essentials if you're a fan of martial arts cinema. So
yeah, I'm not disappointed I picked up the box set. It'd be nice to see them, nice to see the extras. So, I mean, there are a lot of Wong Hei Fung films, but these sort of stand alone. Bit of Jet Li, bit of Rosamund Kwan. I'm happy.
That's good. Also, we rather fittingly, because obviously it being Kaiju Christmas, we got a trailer for the latest installment in Legendary's Godzilla saga, Godzilla King of the Monsters. So we got to see footage of not only Godzilla but also King Ghidorah, Rodan, and Mothra, and what looks like Kimonga, which is the giant spider we see in both Destroy Monsters and Godzilla and Son. Now, whether or not it's the Kimonga or not, we wait to see. What we saw was some legs coming out of the ground, and nobody seems to be able to pin down exactly who that could be. So very excited to see there's still some surprises. But after the initial trailer, which I thought was very lukewarm, I wasn't overly excited. I have to say that I was super excited after seeing the second trailer. But, I mean, what did you make of it, Stephen? Did you get anything out of it?
I quite like the original trailer, but obviously I'm easier to please because I'm not the core kaiju guy. I have to say, I was a little bit disappointed because it looks a bit dark and gloomy, and is obviously they're doing this sort of legendary universe. So we had the Skull Island Kong film, which trailered this, which was just a load of batshit load of fun.
Yes, definitely.
And moving the tone back to something more akin to the last Godzilla film, I'm a little worried about. However, cast looks great. The monsters look great. I see a bit of Mothra in there. I'm happy with that. So, I'll be going to see it, that's for sure.
I mean, the thing I really liked about this trailer is the fact that they made these monsters seem generally terrifying, which is something I was not expecting, especially when you consider a lot of these monsters were really hit sort of their prime during the Shower era, so it's a little ropey, a little bit of fun. So to have these monsters have real sort of presence and weight, and certainly when you look at characters like Rodan, who's always this goofy-looking eagle, to see him, like, decimating cities, and you see him, like, coming out of the volcano, and it's just really, really cool, especially when he does the barrel roll. There's just so much to enjoy in this trailer, and the same fact, it's not giving anything away still, it's just really sort of setting up some interesting things, and I'm really excited to see when it comes out. I think this will be one of those few films that I actually leave the house to go and see, which is always a rarity because I don't tend to see much of the cinema these days.
No, I'll definitely be there too, and I suspect we'll have a special edition of the podcast just to talk about it, because how many kaiju films do we get?
This is the thing. I mean, it's always nice to have a big giant monster movie, especially one that knows its subject matter. I mean, obviously we had like Pacific Rim, we obviously had Kong Skull Island, as you said, so I'm just really excited to see where this goes, and I just hope it has more of a focus on the actual monsters this time, rather than a soldier's journey like the previous Godzilla movie that we had, so...
Yeah, I was really disappointed with that. I mean, when Godzilla got on screen, it was great. The first act, when you had, what's his name from Breaking Bad, and Malcolm in the middle in it, that was good.
Yeah, Bryan Cranston.
But the middle section, yeah, the Bryan Cranston bit was good. But as soon as the spoilers killed him off, the film dragged horrendously until the second half of the final act.
I mean, also on the Godzilla kick, the Godzilla anime, which has been sort of very decisive amongst fans. People have either liked it or they hated it. The third entry, Godzilla Planet Eater, is going to be on Netflix as of January, so a nice birthday treat for myself, and hopefully a turn up for the people who haven't been enjoying it so far. So I'm really excited to see, because this one's obviously going to introduce King Ghidorah. The previous one gave us Mecha Godzilla, so it's going to be interesting to obviously see what they do with King Ghidorah in this one, especially because when it's come to the actual kaiju, the animation and the movement of these creatures hasn't been the best. Godzilla himself has been perhaps a little more lumbering mountain than the sprightly fellow that we're kind of used to seeing in these films. So, but more excitingly, obviously, we are now at the end of the year, and we start seeing a lot of the top 10 and the best of lists have started coming out. Some say a little early, since we've still got a few weeks left in the year. But Eastern Kicks have started producing their top 10, which, Stephen, you obviously are inside man for. So have we got things to look forward to in the top 10, do you reckon?
We have. So this year I have taken part, which I didn't do last year. It's a very complicated process in how the films get shortlisted and chosen. One of the films I reviewed made the final list, but I also, the film that is number one is the film that I also chose to be number one, so I'm very happy with that. And there'll be a review of me of Drucker Wanwild, Satan's Slaves, which I can say now because the list is going to be complete before this podcast comes out. It's a nice mix of the art house and the crowd pleasers. I know sometimes these lists, democracy is a bit of a bitch, especially when you get a bunch of critics around, which is something else we might talk about in a minute. And sometimes I think the crowd-pleasing genre films don't always get their due. But I think this year we've got a nice mix of some really good genre stuff and some more arthousey films, but are definitely worth your time.
Fantastic. As of the time of recording, they'd already announced their pick for 10.2 on the list was The Night Comes for Us, which we discussed in our previous episode. So if you haven't discovered this film on Netflix already, definitely go check it out, and you can certainly listen back to our review as well. I mean, The Night Comes for Us, it's still doing great sort of business, especially amongst the fans like The Raid and Headshot. So, I mean, do you think it sort of deserved a place on the top 10 movies of the year?
I think we had a little bit of internal debate on the older internal Eastern Kicks website about whether it deserved or not, but it basically got a lot of love by a lot of people, not just Eastern Kicks people, but, you know, across the spectrum. You know, I quite liked it, if you remember, which I think surprised you a little bit, and people like James and Andy both liked it. So I you know, it's legitimately an Asian film. It's legitimately successful. I think it lacks in certain places, but as a bit of high octane action, I think not much beat it in that regard this year. So yeah, definitely, I think it deserves its place.
Looking back at the year that we've had, Stephen, what would you say out of the 12 films that made up this block of viewing for ourselves, what has been the highlight for yourself? What has been your favourite episode?
Blimey, that's caught me out.
I can give you a minute if you want. If you want a minute, because I can, I've got mine ready to go here. So,
well, why don't we do yours first?
Okay. Well, this is probably only going to add to your ego, but my highlight of the year was The Classic. And I'm kind of afraid to say that because it now means that I'm just going to be bombarded with Korean melodrama forevermore just because I said I liked one of them. But no, if you go back and listen to our classic, I think it was probably one of our most fun episodes to date. Now, The Classic, obviously being a, as we say, it's a Korean melodrama and it goes on for a fair bit. Yet, there was something about this film that was just so bonkers and insane. And so watchable at the same time. In fact, it's a long film, but it's also a very watchable film. I think that it was sort of like a real sort of standout for myself. If I was to sort of pick another one, though, it would probably be the episode we recorded after that, so episode 18, which would be for Perfect Blue. But I'm just a huge Satoshi Kon fan, so I think that would be kind of an obvious episode. But no, number 17, The Classic, was probably my highlight of this year so far, but... What about yourself, Stephen? Do you have a favourite episode, Tom?
Well, I really enjoyed The Classic episode as well. Because it was almost done as a dare to our special guest. almost as a reaction to what we were just talking about. You know, about choosing a film that I didn't think would appeal to either of you. And what we ended up with was probably one of our longer episodes as well, wasn't it? We all found something in it. We had tons to talk about. And I was really surprised how much you guys liked it. And in a way, it's like a book club, isn't it? I've bought this film and I'm thinking, oh dear, I don't know if the guys are going to like this. But I thought, well, the worst thing that's going to happen could be a complete train crash and no one's hurt. But actually, the fact that you both actually enjoyed it, you know, yourself and Zoe, both thought, actually, that wasn't too bad. And we had plenty to talk about and we learnt lots as we were going along. That was really good. I also really liked, and I'm not sure, does episode 12 count? Yeah, in February.
Yeah, 12 will count.
Yeah, when we talked about Pedicab Driver. And I really like that because Sammo Hung isn't somebody I'd really explored before. I was aware of him. He's been in plenty of films that I'd seen. And when you picked it up, when you chose it, I thought, oh dear, that's probably a little bit hardcore Hong Kong kung fu chop suey sort of film for me, but it was really freaking enjoyable. And that was an episode where I, you know, I thought, oh, I want to go and get hold of this film properly now and explore it a little more. So that was probably mine. Yeah, Pedicab Driver.
Yeah, I mean, Pedicab Driver, I think it was bizarre because there was a pick I remember the first half of the film better than the second half because it had some real weird tonal shifts in that film. But again, the martial arts work in it is just real classic Sammo Hung stuff, and there's some really good comedy in it as well. It's so it's definitely a fun little movie, and one worth certainly making the effort to sort of track down, be it either on the Made in Hong Kong VHS or if you can get an import on DVD or Blu-ray. It's definitely one worth checking out. Now, which would you say was the least favourite episode of this season? Because for myself, the film which I enjoyed the least this year would be The Place Promised in Our Early Days, which was episode 15.
Yeah, so you're giving me the best episode and the worst episode.
You know, it's like a hug and a kick to the nuts all in one. Yeah, Place Promised in Our Dreams, really sumptuous animation from the makers of Your Name. This is a film just so... It has emotional notes, but it's so caught up in its own mythos and randomness that I just could not make head or tail. It just kept feeling like every 15 minutes I was watching the start of a different anime. And that's what really sort of detracted from it. And I just really struggled to sort of get really invested in this. But I know there's people out there who really do like it. And I think, Stephen, you were a fan of this one. And it's one of our more diverse ones.
I full responsibility for picking it. The minute I rewatched it, I thought, oh, this isn't going to go down well. My memories of it were somewhat different. I mean, I'll still stand by it as a film that's worth seeing. But it might not have even been the best film to choose from that director. I think, for me, the one I actually was most disappointed by was probably number 15, The Place Promised in Our Early Days, I think. And that was my pick. Other than that, though, I think we've had a really strong... You know, I don't think all the films have maybe sold both of us. You know, I'm still not buying The Killer.
No, that was what I was surprised you didn't say. I was so expecting you to go, I enjoyed the film.
No, I enjoyed the film, okay. And I enjoyed the episode, and I enjoyed recording the episode. It's just, I could spend a long time picking holes in it. When we did Perfect Blue, that was another episode. I mean, it's an amazing film, and I'm not sure we really dug down into it enough. I don't know, one day there'll be another edit of it. We do it again. But frankly, I think we've had a pretty strong, you know, even films like Turtles Are Surprisingly Fast Swimmers, which I didn't think you would like.
No.
I think we both came out of it enjoying, didn't we?
I was disappointed by Turtles Are Surprisingly Fast Swimmers ultimately. There was issues with it that I didn't have, and it was kind of annoying that I picked it because it was one that I wanted to see for a while, and there was just elements in it which didn't work for me, and it was annoying because we had a couple of great female leads in it, but we just had this bumbling spy couple in it who would just really took me out of it. And I think it's just one of those things that I'm gonna come back to in a few months and probably may have a different take on it. But as I said, it would always be a toss up between those two episodes, either The Place Promised in Our Early Days or Turtles Surprise the Fast Swimmers, which was sort of the least enjoyable. But that being said, it was still a very enjoyable year of cinema that we've had on the show. There's no sort of picks that have been like, oh my god, that was like the worst thing ever. There's just things that have been either great or things that just were flawed, I found this year. So that's kind of where I'm standing, as it were. But as of yet, we've still to see what you made in Gamma 3, so maybe this will all change by the end of the episode, so...
It might do.
Okay.
It won't.
Before we go and break those, Stephen, I mean, is there anything else that's sort of standing out for yourself since the last episode? Any releases or anything?
Well, yeah. So, sort of going back to the Eastern Kicks Top 10, I had to watch a lot of films since we last spoke. I'll just give a shout out to a few of them. First up, as I just hinted, Joko Anwar's remake of an old Indonesian 1980s horror film, Satan's Slaves. The original film was, I don't know, shall we say, unique for being based within the Islamic faith rather than a traditional Indonesian or even a Western Christian set of mythology. The remake is brilliant. Now, I watch a lot of horror films. I do jump at jump scares. I do get grossed out at gross stuff. Sorry, Zoe. But I don't actually get scared very often. I had to turn this one off when I first watched it because I was bricking myself in the watching it in my bedroom late at night. So, really good. Another film I think I talked about, I was about to watch it, which is One Cut of the Dead, which says it's a zombie comedy a la Shaun of the Dead. It's not. It's a film about indie filmmaking, and it's fucking brilliant. That's given us an E on iTunes, hasn't it?
I think we already hit that before there, so...
I finally got round to watching Daughter of the Nile, which is a slow cinema job from Hu Hsiao-hsien, Taiwanese sort of new wave director. I won't be bringing it to the film club. Really enjoyable, but yeah, in the same realms as things like that we might have found on that top 25 list, but really enjoyable, so I've had for a while. An American film called Origin Story, which is about, it's a documentary about a Laotian American comedian who's quite big in podcasts and YouTube-y and stuff like that, having a journey back to her, finding her father who's still in Laos, and finally a film from Vietnam called Go Go Sisters, which is actually a remake of a Korean film called Sunny. Sunny is a brilliant film, and Go Go Sisters for a remake is even better. It's a sort of feel good movie set both in I think sort of mid 80s Vietnam and then sort of 20 years previous, about a group of girls growing up and where they've come now. There's some sadness, there's some laughter, there's some dancing, it's just a huge amount of fun. And until I saw One Cut of the Dead, that was going to be my film of the year. So I've watched a lot, but luckily it's all been really good. Actually, there's a couple of others, but I'm not going to waste any more time on them. But I've had a very lopsided year where December, early December and late November have been full of really good new films.
Yeah, that's cool. I've got stuff to watch, but at the same time, I've had stuff that's been going off the movie channel before I've had a chance to get around to watching it. But so it's sort of like being a weighing up between, do I watch this Western cinema that I'm going to end up having to either like pay to watch later or hope that it shows up on Netflix, or do I sort of run the gambit and just check out the Asian cinema? Because I've got a fair few interesting things. I think I mentioned on the last podcast, the fact I've got such a thing such as like The Piper still to watch. So I'm really looking forward to getting into that, especially because we've obviously got the festive season coming up. So hopefully find some time when I'm not, you know, cooking for in-laws and having people descend on me to sponge off my hospitality to get some film watching done, because, you know, I've got no shortage of films to watch. It's just not got the time there to watch them. So hopefully by the time we record this next show, I have some feedback on some of those bits that have been sort of sitting in the watch pile for a bit too long. We are going to take a quick break now. When we return, though, we will be diving into tonight's selection, which is Gamera 3, The Revenge of Iris.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, LaVern, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, will be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we are going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You, of course, are still listening to Asian Cinema Film Club. This, of course, is Kaiju Christmas, and tonight we are talking about Gamera 3, The Revenge of Iris, the 1999 film, and obviously the third in the 90s trilogy of Gamera films. This, in total, is the 11th Gamera film, and it was the follow-up to Gamera 2, Attack of the Legion. And this was one of the few Gamera movies that actually got distribution to the UK. Ironically, they missed off Guardian of the Universe, which was the first part of this trilogy, went straight into Gamera 2, Attack of Legion, and then gave us Gamera 3, The Revenge of Iris, and kind of expected British fans to, you know what the hell's going on. But the film itself is directed by Shizuke Kaneko, who is not only obviously known for this film, he has also did a film that we've also reviewed on the show, which was Death Note. He did the 2006 live adaptation. He also directed the previously mentioned Gamera Guardian of the Universe in 95, Gamera 2 Attack of Legion in 96, as well as Azumi 2 Death or Love. And he also did a single Godzilla movie with Godzilla, Mothra and King Ghidorah, got Giant Monsters All Out Attack in 2001. So definitely he is a man with kaiju stock. And this third film you can actually watch without having seen the other films in the trilogy. It is very much a standalone film, as it and it makes actually quite a few references to the previous films that fills in a lot of the gaps, including a sort of slideshow montage at the start of the film where we get to see the parts of Guardians of the Universe, but completely removes any footage from Attack of Legions. So the film itself, it features this young girl called Anya, who is basically, she holds this big grudge against Gamera because he inadvertently killed her parents and her pet cat when he was fighting Gaius in the first film of the trilogy. And since then, she's sort of like really sort of bottled up her rage and finds a way to sort of finally strike back at the fire-breathing space turtle Gamera when she discovers a monster which she names Iris, which forms a psychic bond with her and grows to ginormous size, and ultimately goes on a sort of collision course with Gamera as the two sort of battle it out for sort of domination in what is hinted at sort of having a larger mythological setting to this sort of showdown between them. But I mean, Stephen, what did you obviously make of Gamera 3, Revenge of Iris?
I bloody loved it.
Fantastic.
I bloody loved it. So I had previously seen the first film in the series,
okay,
Guardian of the Universe, and I bloody love that. In fact, I love the whole trilogy. Yeah, they've got scope and storyline and giant monsters and just all sorts of interesting things going on in them that sometimes kaiju movies don't have. I mean, one could argue it's a little overpacked in plot lines and psychic people and weird shit going on. But I know, hugely enjoyable. I mean, I know it's quite well thought of, isn't it, amongst the kaiju intelligentsia as a rule. But there's no mistake, it's a hugely enjoyable film.
Yeah, I mean, this is... First of all, while it obviously looks on the surface like a Godzilla movie, I mean, obviously the fact that, you know, it's a kaiju movie, so it's a giant monster stomping on Tokyo. The sort of noticeable differences, first off, with the Gamera movies is the fact that the Gamera movies are very high on sort of like blood and gore, and also on the collateral damage, as we obviously discuss a bit later in the film. But in this film, it has to be said, Gamera's a little clumsy when it comes to the world-saving effort. And I mean, Gamera is known as not only the guardian of the universe, but also the friend to all children, which is an interesting tagline to say the least. And with this 90s trilogy, it was sort of a more darker take on the character, much like the Godzilla movies of this era as well. They both sort of brought darker turns to these characters, and certainly we see this in the fact that when the whole sort of like fuel for the film, it being the fact that it's this girl who just wants revenge on Gamera, she sees Gamera as this destructive presence. And at the same time, we've got these occultists, Miss Asakura and Kurata Shinya, who believe that Gamera is this evil spirit. So we've got a lot of really random themes thrown into this movie, even though you could sort of like boil it down to just Gamera fights Monster of the Week, which in this case is Iris is kind of like an essence sucking multi-tentacled octopus thing.
So what I thought Iris was like was like a Pokemon that sort of powered up to extreme levels, really evolved, didn't it?
Yeah.
from this kind of a kind of suggestive looking multi-tentacled creature, and there's a little bit of hentai goes on, doesn't it? There's a tentacle or two that creeps up a school skirt and stuff like that. A little bit of that's going on, and then sort of becomes this gigantic, I don't know what you'd call it, really, sort of energy vampire,
yeah,
beast. But it's very interesting. It's very different to the sort of dinosaur. I know it's a giant turtle with tusks, but you know, Gamera looks more like a dinosaur unless he's not flying. Unless he is flying, and then he looks like a spaceship.
It's when Gamera flies, he has the two modes. He has the flying turtle mode, which is where he uses his front flippers to sort of steer, and his back legs become giant rocket boosters. And he also has his alternate fly mode, which is basically where he just spins around and can somehow maneuver with great ease. On top of this, I mean, Gamma obviously is able to breathe fire, which is... It's kind of an unusual power because it seems to go everywhere but where he intends it to go half the time, as we see with, like, cities just being engulfed in flames, people being blown up into the sky, and generally, whenever, in this film especially, whenever Gamera gets into a fight, it's just, like, massive collateral damage. We see buildings being knocked, people being, like, crushed in rubble, and it seems like he causes more trouble to the people of Japan than he's supposed to be helping them, so... It's not surprising the fact that the film also takes a little, like, has these little offshoots where you have people being interviewed and they ask them what they think of Gamera, and they're none too pleased with Gamera, it has to be said, even though he's obviously saving them from a rival giant monster.
And had saved them from Legion and the Gaios before. It did feel a bit like with three movies in, we're roughly 5-6 hours into this story, if you take the other two films, and they're still questioning him. They shouldn't have had this discussion maybe in the last movie, I don't know, but this one really did feel like it was more like a sequel to the first movie. Like you talked about at the beginning when they're sort of doing the recap of what happened before. It's all about the first movie, and what's the girl called? What did you say her name was?
Ascara?
Aida's character. No. Obviously, she's back in it, but they sort of retrospectively put in Ayana, don't they?
Oh yeah, that's right. Who has that sort of psychic link with Gamera? So she makes an interesting counterpoint, because obviously with Ascara having a psychic link with Iris, so you've got these two sort of characters, even though Gamera no longer has that that psychic link with Ayana.
So Ayana is the girl with Iris, and I can't remember.
I'm getting all confused here today. Yes,
you are.
Ayana is the girl who is with Iris, because she obviously she's the one who discovered it, so she's the one holding the grudge there.
Yeah, but then there is another girl from the first film who had the psychic powers to control Gamera in the first film, and she comes back, but she hasn't, like you say, she hasn't got the powers. There's a lot of bloody unpacking some of this. There's a lot of sort of people floating around, and actually, Gamera is barely in it. He's like this force of nature that just appears over the horizon sometimes, or behind a city block to knock it down.
Yeah, because, I mean, Gamera's main sort of focus for the first three quarters of his film movie, he's too busy staying with the Gaios still, who, while they're obviously not a main feature of this film, they're still very much a presence, and we're led to believe that they're a result of mana, which is like this life force produced by the Earth, and that Gamera is a creation of mana, and that's why he hangs around Japan, because it's like this central hub for mana. And there's a lot of this. How do you describe it? It's sort of like spiritual
New Age bullshit.
Yes, this New Age nonsense that's sort of thrown around. So if you've ever played a JRPG, sort of like Final Fantasy, then you probably know a lot of this stuff already, because it's the sort of thing that's thrown around in there a lot. So
yeah, and there's that weird thing at the beginning where you see all these, I don't know, corpses of previous Gameras, and they sort of say, yes, that must be because the people that created the first one had lots of versions, and you think, oh, maybe they're all going to come up, but nothing's ever done with it. It's like there's so much effort put into the backstory, isn't there, which is really strange.
It's bizarre. There's this really bizarre opening, as you said. We've got the Gamera graveyard at the start, and nothing's ever really made of that. And at the end, we end with this swarm of Gaios, like thousands of Gaios descending on Japan. And we never get to see what happens with that either, because they go into a completely different saga after this film. So it's...
That's right. It sort of ends, doesn't it? And you think, oh, is there going to be a fourth film? But no, there isn't. It's like, yeah, Gamera just keep on doing what he's got to do. The battle is never ending. And it's a bit of a downer in some ways, isn't it?
I know what you're saying. It is, and it's I think it kind of detracts from the film in the way the fact that we have these unanswered questions by the end of this trilogy. You would have thought that being a trilogy, that all the sort of answers of the series would all be sort of wrapped up and everything would be brought together to this big sort of final sort of showdown. But it's not the case. The guards are still pestering the Earth. The only thing that gets sort of resolved is the fact that Iris gets her peripheral ass handed to her by Gamera after the inevitable beatdown of Gamera. As these things go, you know, our hero monster gets beaten down only to swing it back in the final act. And I mean that the final sort of showdown, which is really the last 15 minutes of the film. How do you find that sort of showdown? Because it's very sort of different than the sort of kaiju showdowns we're probably obviously used to from like looking at things like Destroy Monsters, where it's sort of like these super monster sized smackdowns. With this one, it's just very sort of animalistic. It's these two sort of monsters basically charging each other and sort of like wrestling and trying to get the upper hand on each other. It's not very much as much of a spectacle as we've like expect from like the Godzilla movies, for example.
It is different, yeah. And I think the wrestling idea that you just put forward is probably the best way of describing it. I mean, there's something about just the scale of them, which isn't always... So quite often what we see is, in these sort of films, is that the monsters sort of face off in a desert or in some barren landscape, don't they? And they sort of run at each other or shoot fire at each other. This is a... They're in the city, aren't they? And they're above the... You know, and it really feels like there's these monstrous, uncontrollable things. And yes, they can shoot fire and fly and suck everyone's energy out and all that kind of thing, but at the end of the day it's a very physical, but I'm trying not to use the word realistic because it's not.
Within this world, it's got a sense of realism to it.
Indeed, in a hyper-realistic way, it's very realistic. Quite unlike sort of a lot of the Godzilla movies that I've seen, for example.
Yeah.
You know, when we looked at Destroy All Monsters, they're all out there in the middle of nowhere. Is it even on Earth, that one? Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
That is on Earth. But you know, and the human beings are watching it from miles away. Or there might be some tanks or something that turn up, but you know, there's a distance between where it's happening and human beings, whereas this is in and amongst us. And there's some brilliant shots. It almost, do you know what it reminded me of most? It reminded me of the original Godzilla film.
Yeah.
In many ways, you know, the scenes in that early bit where Gamera's taking on the Gaios and he kills 20,000 people. But takes time to save one little boy, which is another weird thing that it does. You know, he appears from behind skyscrapers and he looks genuinely monstrous and nearly realistic. And I think the fighting is also in that envelope as well.
Yeah, I think with the actual sort of action scenes, as you said, I mean, with the Godzilla movies, if there was like battles are in the city, you would always have scenes of them like people like running to sort of Godzilla bunkers, so to speak. Everyone gets into safety. In this film, people are just like running because this chaos is happening around them. The fact that these monsters are battling each other and these people are sort of caught in the crossfire here, and as you said, it is very similar to the original Godzilla movie, which despite what people assume the Godzilla movies to be, the original Godzilla movie is just like a very sort of straight monster movie. And the fact that we have like the shots of the field hospitals and all these like injured people and these really sort of sober moments throughout that film, compared to obviously the sort of more hokey sort of aspects that came with the later films, especially like in the Showa era. And with this film, it's, as I say, it's completely different. You know, people are getting caught in the crossfire. We see them being blown up or crushed under rubble. And as you say, it's bizarre that we have that one child who gets sort of saved. And it's kind of like them trying to work in the knowledge. It's sort of like, see, he's still the friend to all children.
Yeah, when you said that, then that kind of made sense. You're like, oh, Gamera, he saved me. And you think, I'm surprised I even noticed you, mate. He's about 400 feet tall. It's like a bit strange, but then the whole film is full of these weird little moments, isn't it? Like the game developer. Can we talk about him?
Yes, because apparently the Sega Dreamcast is what's going to save the world.
Well, there's a huge advert there for the Sega Dreamcast. And indeed, I'm a bit of a retro computer guy. The Dreamcast Junkyard website, which is sort of a popular hub for people who still love their Dreamcast, has a whole article written about this this guest starring performance by the Sega Dreamcast. In quite an amusing way, but yeah, that is a bit weird. But there's this guy; he's like a developer, and is he part of the cult? I can't remember.
No, he seems to be. I mean, he's
the voice of madness.
I don't. I mean, as I said, it's hard to say where he sort of comes into it. I think he's sort of like a friend of Mayumi, who is this scientist who's obviously following Gamera, formed this sort of like partnership with Asagi due to her own sort of connection to Gamera, and for some reason she seems to know this guy and is able to, like, she receives this disc through, and apparently it's this game, and it's been used as a way to simulate like different conditions on Earth and how it would affect like Gaios reproduction on Earth, from what I gathered. Is it's a really bizarre sequence, and the fact that we would obviously go with
That's the sort of game that Sega were putting out at the time, and that's probably why the Dreamcast failed, because they had too many world building simulation games.
Do not bash the Dreamcast. The Dreamcast was epic. I loved it.
I'm looking at my Dreamcast now. Don't you worry about it. But it was really weird and out of place in that film, and it was like this. It was like this advert, and it does match up. I mean, this is 1999, isn't this film? And in Japan, yeah, it came out late 1998. So I think it really is a product placement, and it's as subtle as a tin of spam. But this guy, this game developer, he's in a different film to everybody else.
It's true.
Everyone else is taking it very seriously and fairly, in a fairly po-faced way. He's hamming it up like it's pantomime season, up until his death, where he goes, "Ooh, isn't it scary?" and gets crushed.
It's
very weird.
Well, the whole film just tonally is weird, and it's not helped at all by the dub track. For this one, because I mean, this film was put out by AVM here in the UK. I'm not too sure about the States, but the dub track for this film is absolutely horrible. If you can watch this film subtitles, then I'll definitely go that route, because the dub track is just like, it doesn't ever seem to match up.
I only managed to get a dub version, and I hate watching films with dubs. I add an element of humour to it, as dubbing tracks normally do, but I will watch it again when I can find a subtitle version, for sure.
So, now the actual sort of fight scenes, just going back to those again, I mean, the camera work as well, it's all very sort of low shot, so we get a very great sense of scale. We also get a really nice combination of both rain and fire, which is something I've not really seen in any other kaiju movie. And we also get real sort of blending of both CGI effects and traditional suit work for the monsters. Here, taking the role of Iris, we had Akira Oshira, who wore the Gamera suit for Attack of Legion and would go on to work on Godzilla, Mothra and King Ghidorah, Giant Monsters All Attack, where he played King Ghidorah. He also did some work on Kamen Rider as well. In the Gamera suit here, we have the legendary Hiro Fukuzawa. I'm going to apologise, as always, if I mispronounce any of these names, who was part of the Red Action Club. And he did a whole bunch of work on, like, the Super Sentai series and the Kamen Rider series as well. So he was someone who definitely associated with the, like, Tokusatsu sort of series. And it's really, he does a really good job as Gamera, even though he really hasn't got a lot to do in this film, because And I think this may be a little distracting for people who sort of come into this thinking, oh, I'm going to watch a Gamera movie and then only get really sort of like 15 minutes of Gamera. But at the same time, it's not like when we saw the American Godzilla remake where we thought we'd been cheated. Here, the film, where it uses Gamera and where it uses Iris, it really sort of makes sense. And it didn't feel like I was losing anything by not having Gamera be this sort of like overwhelming presence throughout the film, even though it is obviously his name on the title there.
No, I agree. There's another thing. Am I right in thinking these three films were distributed by Toho, where Gamera is actually Daiei's property?
Yep. He's property to Daiei, and obviously and as you said, these films were distributed by Toho, who obviously are Godzilla's production place.
Yeah, it's just I wondered why that was. Was it just about money or something like that? Because there's just a production quality to all three films that puts them a class above, I think. And I just wondered why. What was going on in Godzilla Land at this time?
Godzilla Land, it sounds like a magical place, doesn't it? So obviously, 1999, greatest movie year ever. Obviously, for Godzilla, we're looking at the Millennium period. So these are really sort of like dark movies. And if you look at these films, again, there is, like we see with this film, there's that blending of CGI effects as well as traditional suit work. And for the Godzilla films, it's really they're sort of like picking up where the first attempt by the Americans to remake, so the 97 Godzilla. So they start off obviously with Godzilla 2000 Millennium, which was released in 1999. That's followed up by Godzilla Against Mechagodzilla and Godzilla Tokyo SOS. And then we end with what should have really been the sort of the final film in like the whole series, which was 2004's Godzilla Final Wars, which is by the same director of Versus and Izumi.
It is. That's the one where they give American Godzilla a little disrespect.
Yeah, Ryuhei Kitamura. I mean, he was like so beyond honored to be asked to do Godzilla Final Wars. I mean, he still like proclaimed the honor of being asked to do a Godzilla movie as being the same as like a British director being asked to direct a Bond movie. He was like completely like in awe of the fact he was asked to do it, and the fact that he gave us basically an update version of Destroy All Monsters, in the fact that with Final Wars we have every monster from the Godzilla back catalogue coming together and just, you know, getting to showcase their stuff. And for a lot of these monsters, I mean, it would have been like 20 odd years since we saw them, so you got to see like monsters like Kumanga, or Spiger, as it was bizarrely dubbed here in the UK, which is obviously the giant spider. We got to see Anglis, who's my all-time favorite. As you said, most memorably, we got to see Godzilla versus Zilla in a fight that lasts all of a couple of seconds, as Godzilla goes on his round the world trip, beating up monsters around the globe, and he faces Zilla in Sydney, Australia, and basically just blasts him into the New York, into the Sydney Opera House and blows him up. But it was, you know, it's a fun little nod. And I know there's people out there who don't really like Godzilla Final Wars, but I had a lot of fun with it. And I think it's one we're going to look at a later date. But certainly tonally, these films match what we're obviously seeing with this trilogy. It's a darker kaiju movie. I mean, gone are the sort of, I don't like to use the word hokey, but they were sort of like the more sort of fun movies of like The Shower Road, which was like 1954 to 1975. So when you've got things such as you said, you've got things such as like Destroy All Monsters, All Monsters Attack, and like Godzilla vs. Gigan, those sort of like fun little monster movies that are really what sort of got me into Godzilla movies to begin with. And it's sort of really from that sort of point on, they sort of get a lot darker as we see things such as like 84 giving us like the Return of Godzilla, which makes Godzilla evil again. And this sort of continues in, we even though they're obviously like darker movies, we get some real sort of classics in this sort of period with things such as like Godzilla versus King Ghidorah, which gave us Mecha King Ghidorah. So, but I mean, obviously back to Gamera 3 Revenge of Iris, it's I really enjoy this. My favorite of the trilogy. Whether it's my favorite Gamera movie of all time, I think it's up there, but I'm not sure if it's my all-time favorite. I think there's a couple of others that I would put above it, but it's certainly one that's worth checking out, certainly. And the ending in particular, I have to say, it takes the word badass to a whole new level, would you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I really enjoy all three of these films, and I'm not the kaiju guy. Right? I don't know anything of his hokier past. I think we spoke before, didn't we? When I said, "Oh, I like Gamera," and you like sneered at me because I might have preferred it a little to most Godzilla films.
Yeah, well, that's understandable. I mean, it's.
I'm definitely part of a different gang. I just think there's a maturity to them and a complexity to them. I mean, they're not deep. They're not going to win Oscars or anything, are they? But there is so much going on, you're not going to get bored.
No.
You're going to get confused. You're going to think that's a bit weird. But there's a level of maturity, so questions being asked. You know, there's the badass fighting shit, yeah? But there's also stuff like, oh, it's talking about ecology and... collateral damage, and we actually get an answer to why does Japan always get attacked by giant monsters. Don't like the answer, but you know, at least it tries, you know. I just really, really enjoyed it, and I think you probably knew I was going to. Although it was chosen by our audience, so maybe I could have had a worse experience.
There were some interesting titles. I mean, there was titles on the list which I think we may have gone down that more sort of hokier sort of route. And again, I mean, even though these films are sort of hokey, they're still fun. They're still very proficient filmmaking, despite what a lot of snark casters would have you believe. And they go a lot deeper than sort of like, you know, men in monster suits sort of having wrestling with each other and outlandish plots. There's often a lot more going on. And same with this trilogy, it tried to do something a little deeper with the actual films, and certainly the darker tone makes them really sort of stand out from the Godzilla movies, even though you'd think, oh, it's just, you know, it's a Godzilla movie, just this time it's like a giant fire-breathing turtle that also can fly, which is a fun enough premise on its own without obviously adding all this sort of like death. It adds spirituality and mythology and as you said, new age stuff to the proceedings, which sort of it only makes worse. And I love the premise of this idea that this girl is so fueled by rage, the fact that she goes and finds herself a monster to go and fight Gamera, and the fact it evolves from just like a cute little dinosaur to this hulking essence stealing beast that's like framed in fire whenever we see it in its full size. So
I really like that that sort of story cycle of Ayana, where it takes her bloody ages to see reason, doesn't it?
Well, this is fancy. But so actually,
I thought that was quite realistic, because you know, there were several points in the story where she could have calmed down. Oh yeah, it's all right, really. Oh, I've been such a silly girl for thinking this. I mean, she's committed to it till 10 minutes from the end of the film. It takes quite a lot for her to suddenly realise that she's become a bigger monster than Gamera ever was, or that she's the host of the bigger monster. And I really like that. I thought you know, it could have been a petulant little schoolgirl, and it could have been annoying, but I actually felt it was... I thought it was justified, you know. She lost her parents...
And a cat.
Don't forget about the cat. Which is why the monster's called Iris, because it's the same name as a cat, isn't it?
Yep.
And but yeah, I also like the way they brought the other characters back. You know, the a couple of them from the first film as well, and just gave it a cohesive sense that this really was a trilogy and not just three films that happened to star Gamera and have the same director.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously bring back Inspector Osako from the first
film. Oh, I forgot about him, yes.
And he's now basically like a homeless drunk. And I wonder, why did we bring him back? Because he doesn't really do anything in this film apart from to give sort of like some sort of connection to bring the films together, and really to give Mayumi a sort of like a sidekick of sorts. But he doesn't really do much at all in this film at all. It made me wonder why we bring him back.
The film is populated with a lot of people, isn't it? Yeah, she sees him in the street and she goes, "Oh, it's like this drunk Asaka. Oh no, not me. that's not me." And then 20 minutes later, he's sort of by her side because, well, shit's gone down and he's sobered up by being hit by chunks of flaming Gaios, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's sort of like with Gamera, he's sort of like a heroic character, but he's not very good at it. It's sort of like, I've got these amazing abilities, so I can like breathe fire and I can fight other giant monsters, but at the same time, I'm just going to cause massive destruction. So people are going to wonder, why are you doing this?
And that's a bit about the kid bit that makes no sense, because, you know, if he's a force of nature and is fairly ignorant of the human beings, and he's just doing what he's been designed to do, which is to kill Gaios,
yeah.
I get that, and that's an interesting thing in itself, and I suspect that's actually what the new Godzilla film that we were talking about earlier is possibly going for. These monsters, and what can we do? We are nothing to them,
yeah.
And they don't really know us. But then that he can see and understand this little 7-year-old boy needs to be saved is it's something I have a sort of a circle I have trouble squaring. But it's still, what am I expecting?
Cool. Further viewing. Unless there's anything else you want to discuss in this one?
No, I think I'm done. I'm just again want to reiterate, really good film. Okay. Further viewing. See, I really struggled with this because the obvious way to go would be one of the other Gamera films, yep, by Shusuke Kanako. I especially like the first one. And I would definitely, if you were going to watch this, I know you said that it sort of stands alone, but some of the supporting characters make a bit more sense when you've seen the first film. I then thought, actually, Shusuke Kaneko, he's our first repeated director, I think, isn't he? He's the first guy that we've spoken about two of his films.
Yep, 'cause he obviously directed Death Note as well.
And so I was going to suggest another one of his films, which is Azumi 2, Death or Love. Now, the original Azumi, not done by him, it's a fantastic film, and it's on my list to try and talk about this year. But Azumi 2 is really entertaining as well. I mean, it's not as clever as the first film, but it's got a few names and faces in it that are recognisable, including Jackie Kuriyama is in it, from Kill Bill and Battle Royale and plenty of other things, as is Ai Maeda, who is Ayana in this film. So you can link up a director and a star in it as well.
Yeah, definitely. Just have a look. So I know that the girl from Kill Bill. As I said, the girl from Kill Bill, is that?
Yep, Chucky.
Oh, sorry, my mistake. Okay, I'm going to shut up now.
So what about you?
Okay, obviously the most obvious one would be we go and pair it with something from Godzilla, but just obviously saying on the Gamera sort of tact, there are some fun ones there, especially if we look at the Showa period 4 Gamera movies, which runs between 1965 and 1980. There are some fun titles there. I mean, obviously, Gamera and the Giant Monster is probably the best place to start with those. I mean, that was released way back in 1965. Get my knees confused here, because it was re-released in America the following year as Gamera the Invincible. But and they also spoke Gamera really weird, because they spoke Gamera instead of the proper word, which is Gamera. But yeah, I mean, it's a fun little black and white monster movie, and the only one in the series to be shot in black and white. But I think it's a good starting point for this series, as you said, right? For the series. I mean, you can watch the whole this Ensite period and start with Guardian of the Universe of 95 and just watch these three films, and I think that's really a fun one. The one I'm going to pair it with is a little bit of a random choice, but I think it's still a film that you may get a kick out of. And this is a North Korean kaiju movie called Pulgasari, and it's one I'm going to talk about on a later sort of show. And this is actually directed on the orders of Kim Jong-il. And he basically kidnapped the director and his wife. This is directed by Shin Sang-ok. And he basically, as I said, he kidnapped the director and his wife, not only to teach him filmmaking techniques, because he was a renowned film buff, rumoured to own one of the largest movie collections in the world, and basically kidnapped this director to make a number of films, and one of these films being Pulgasari, which has been seen by many as a sort of communist propaganda movie, in the fact that we have this giant monster, which is stomping over a feudal Korea, and it's only by the villagers teaming together in the spirit of communism, no less, that they're able to defeat the monster. But this is a film which has got some really interesting monster sequences, most interestingly of all when they not only capture the monster in a cage but also have it completely ablaze. So this is a man in a monster suit inside a blazing cage, which anyone who knows anything about sort of Asian health and safety probably wouldn't be surprised that they did such a thing. I mean, this is with these films, I mean, it's not unheard of for actors to be spray painted while inside the monster suits in cases when they wanted to reuse the monster suits. But Pulgasari is a really fun movie from North Korea from 1985, and one that's definitely worth checking out, even if it is a little controversial because of the communist themes throughout. So those would be my two sort of picks for you.
And kind of interesting, because the story of Shin Sang-ok, the director, is going to be in one of my Dark Tales. So that'll be a nice tie-up if we ever get that far.
Fantastic. Well, this brings us to the end, not only of end of this year's recording for the Asian Cinema Film Club, as we wrap up 2018 with another fun episode, another fun addition to our ongoing Kaiju Christmas franchise. You know, get to look forward to anime, Kurosawa Kwanzaa, Mickey March, other mums we can attach torture puns to. But yeah, I mean, certainly as we look to 2019, I think it's safe to say we've got plenty of exciting things coming up. We've obviously got our top 50 list coming out. We're going to be looking at more films. We're going to have more features on the blog. So we're going to have more mixtapes. We're going to have more episodes of the Movie and Anime Vault. You know, we're going to have more guests and more than likely more Zobo as well for you. Because we know you folks love when Zoe's on the show, so I would not be surprised if she makes a few more appearances as well. So, but if there are any films you would like to see us cover, please do let us know on Facebook or Twitter. You can let us know on the blog, which, as we said already, is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, and all episodes can be found both on Podomatic, iTunes, Spotify, or through thatmomentin.com's podcast network. As well as our blog. So definitely plenty of ways to catch up on any episodes you might have missed. And, you know, let us know the films you want to see us covering. So, I mean, any sort of final thoughts for 2018, Stephen? Or?
No, it's just been really enjoyable yet again. It was nice thinking about what had been successful and not successful this year. We go from strength to strength. I've even stopped saying I'm surprised we've had another episode. But then I've just broken it by saying that. And all I can say is next year we'll do more of the same, I think. We'll upset a few people along the way, but hopefully we'll both find some new films to tell everybody about.
Yeah. Well, thank you as always for listening. Thank you, of course, to my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Pleasure is all mine.
As always, this is Edward Jones. signing off another edition of Asian Cinema Film Club, and wishing you all a very Merry Kaiju Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will see you in 2019 for more dives into the wonderful world of Asian cinema. Until then, good night. Hey! 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 昨日のコーヒーは忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。月が砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える思いを狂わすのさ。昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。